Okay, tonight we are picking up in Ruth chapter 4, and we will finish out the book of Ruth tonight. And then after tonight, we will get into the book of John. That's our intended next course of study. So picking up in Ruth chapter 4, we begin in verse 1. It says, "Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there." And this was to fulfill the promise that he had made to Ruth. Go back with me to Ruth chapter 3. And if you remember in that section, Boaz agrees to the proposal to marry Ruth and to serve as the kinsman redeemer, the Goel, as the term is referred to. But in Ruth chapter 3, and let me go into verse 10, and this is where Boaz agrees to pay the redemption price. Verse 10, it says, "Then he said to her, 'May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence.'" So here he is promising to serve again as the kinsman redeemer. Verse 12, "Now it is true I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I." And we'll talk about that here in just a little bit when we look at Leviticus and Deuteronomy. But apparently, again, Boaz had looked into this, to the legal aspects of it according to the Mosaic law, and he realized that the privilege did not fall to him first. And so being a godly man, he was concerned about keeping the law. And that's why he makes the comment that he is a close relative. However, there's one closer than I. And he says in verse 13, "Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you. As the Lord lives, lie down until morning." So he makes the promise and he binds it with an oath by citing the name of the Lord when he says, "As the Lord lives." So when we pick up in Ruth 4, 1, it's the very next morning. And Boaz is on his way to the gate. And that's what it says. "Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there." Boaz is a man of his word. And if he says he's going to do something quickly, he does it. "And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by." By chance? Not at all. Again, we see the providence of God here. What's interesting is the name of the close relative is not given. And it could be that his name is withheld because, as we're about to see, he's going to decline the privilege. And so since he is not going to fulfill his duty, some have said that the commentators chose to leave his name out. Sort of a dishonor to him. I don't know that that's the case, but that's the thought of some. But either way, the man's name is not given. But Boaz is going to speak very kindly to him. Notice the latter part of the verse there. "So he said to him, 'Turn aside, friend, sit down here.' And he turned aside and sat down." Verse 2, "He took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit down here.' So they sat down." Now, his words and his actions were a common legal practice at this time because they didn't have very many written documents, so there would have been these persons who were going to serve as, eyewitnesses to this contract that was going to be made. So they sat down. Verse 3, "Then he said to the closest relative," again, not named, he says, "Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land." Now this shows that the land was hers. She had the right to possess land. So it was in her legal possession, which belonged to our brother Elimelech. Now, the word brother here, ach, in the Hebrew, can mean a literal brother, but the term can also mean a relative, a close relative. And we use the term the same way in English. We can refer to somebody as my brother when, in fact, he just may be a friend or even a distant relative. So he says here, Again, Naomi has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to her. She may have been too poor to work the land, and physically not able to work the land, but it was nonetheless hers. It was in her possession. So verse 4 says, "So I thought to inform you," that is according to his legal right. He says, "So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here," that is the eyewitnesses, "and before the elders of my people." Now what's going on here is Boaz is giving him the opportunity to buy this land to keep it within the family. And this was consistent with the Mosaic law. Go with me back to Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 23. Now when we look at the Redeemer, the one who functions as a kinsman redeemer, we should understand it two ways. We should understand it, one, as somebody who had the right to purchase the land to keep it in the family, and also to redeem an individual, a person. And we're going to see where both are true here. But apparently, this closer relative, at this point, Boaz is only informing him about the land. Now, in Leviticus 25, verses 23 through 25, and here God is talking to Israel. He says, "The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently." I want you to keep that in mind, because when land was broken up according to allotment, according to the tribes, when a family got a piece of property, that property was theirs forever. Okay? The property could be sold, but really it wasn't sold. What it was in effect given sort of as a lease to somebody who wanted to work the land. But the land could be bought back if the person came into wealth. And then, of course, on the year of Jubilee, which was every 50th year, the land automatically reverted back to the original owner. Now, that's kind of nice, isn't it? Such that if you had a... Huh?
For the owner.
But that's my point. That's my point. But yeah. You think about land today. We buy a piece of land. Like, I'm paying a mortgage on this house, right? But let's say I pay this house off. Do I really own this house?
No.
The government has the right to claim to make me pay taxes on this home. But if I don't pay my taxes on my home, then the government has the right to come and take my home, so that they get their taxes,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So, really, land ownership really isn't land ownership because of the tax system and the way it's set up. It's not really yours. But in the case here, when land was given by allotment, it was your land. And if you sold it, what you were doing was you were selling the right for somebody else to use the land, like a farmer. But the land could be bought back, and then, of course, on the year of Jubilee, the land automatically reverted back. So sometimes you had to question where you were in the calendar. And if it was 20 years to the year of Jubilee, well, that meant that if you got the land, then you only got it for that duration of time. Okay? But God says here, He says, "The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine." So ultimately, God declares himself to be the owner of the land. "For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor, he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold." And that's what Boaz is here offering to this nearest relative of his when he offers him to buy this land that belongs to Naomi because she's become so poor. So he says to him, again, "Buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people." And then he says, "If you will redeem it." And the word redeem there's our Hebrew word ga'al or goel. And it means to pay the price for freedom. And in this case, they're going to liberate the land. He says, "If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one else but you to redeem it, and I am after you." So what he's doing is he's offering this man the option to buy the land for the purpose of having it within the family, because he's part of the same family, part of the same tribe, and also to help out Naomi. And so he says, and he said to him, I will redeem it. So this guy thinks that this is a good business venture. He probably knows the land. He probably walks by it on a regular basis. He probably knows that it can be worked well. But then Boaz, verse 5, then Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. So now Boaz gives him the second thing here. He didn't give it to him up front, but he gives it to him now, doesn't he? And he mentions Ruth here, and that's according to Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 and 6. Now in this section, what is being redeemed is the person. In this case, the surviving relative of the original owner. Deuteronomy 25:5 says, when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. But then notice verse 6, it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. Now, that's an important point, because the firstborn son of the wife here is going to assume the name, will assume the name of his dead brother, that is the one who died and left her a widow. So the son who's born doesn't bear the name of the guy who fathered him. He bears the name of his dead, of his wife's deceased husband, the first husband. Now, when that happens, who then does the land belong to? Belongs to the son. Okay? So he does his duty and he can work the land for a time, but eventually the right of ultimate ownership within the family goes to the son. You follow that? Now, this is important in the story here, because originally this relative to Boaz says, I'll buy the land. But then when Ruth is mentioned, all of a sudden now there's going to be a shift in the story. Verse 6, so the closest relative says, I cannot redeem it for myself because I would jeopardize my own inheritance. And so the idea here, I think, is that by bearing Ruth and having children, he perceives that he's going to jeopardize the land. He's probably thinking if he gets the land and it's just his, then he just views it as a good investment. But now if he has to marry Ruth and become a father to her children, if a son is born to her, then he is going to get the land. And so then it just becomes a short-term investment. And so he's concerned about that. And at this point, he says, I don't want to jeopardize my own inheritance.
Wait a minute. The son would get it, right?
The son would get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is this kinsman redeemer here. He's a good guy, but he's not a great guy. Boaz is a great guy.
I can't remember who I was listening to. I think it might have been Thomas Constable, but on that particular part, he made reference to, you might have heard it if you listen to him, where he was saying that jeopardize his own inheritance. He was thinking that, you know, now you've got a now you have another son that is not, you know, his own or whatever.
Right.
And so it's kind of like having another child come in and you giving that money or whatever to this child instead of your natural born child.
Right.
He didn't want to do that.
Right. No. I agree. Constable made a good point on that. And we don't know enough about this relative of Boaz to know if he has a son. And he's thinking, if I take part of my money and I buy this land and I marry Ruth and then I work this land, this is an investment. But then if I don't get my return on it, then it doesn't go to my son, my firstborn. You know, it now goes to this other son by way of this marriage.
Yeah.
And so then he forfeits it, and then he may even be thinking that he may forfeit the land that he owns, because if he doesn't have a son, then the son who's born to Ruth may wind up possessing all of it.
Oh,
you see?
The land that he already owns.
The land that he already owns. So again, we don't have all the details here, but there's something in his mind that there's a wrench thrown into the cog as soon as he realizes that he has to marry Ruth and produce offspring by her. And in his mind, he says, I don't want to forfeit my inheritance. I don't want to jeopardize that. So I'm going to pass on this, and I'm going to let you have it, Boaz. That's yours now. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. All that y'all are talking about, like the comment you made, is a comment that, you know, it's, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, that definitely makes sense, because it sounds just like the chosen nation of Israel versus the, or I say versus very lightly, the church.
Uh-huh.
Like the kinsman redeemer. He didn't want to be the kinsman redeemer because then, well, now I'm going to, almost like the stepchild.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to give
this
blessing to the stepchild, and I don't want to do that.
Right.
But Boaz is going to say, okay, you know, I'm good with that. And just like Jesus, you know, the chosen nation of Israel with Gentiles. Or the,
uh-huh.
Here comes the stepchildren that were also blessed. Like, he chose to be our Redeemer, and we received that blessing as well.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. And that's where I think, you know, that in the New Testament, it doesn't specifically cite or refer to Boaz as a type of Christ. But I think there's a lot of parallels there, and I think it's easy to see him as a type because of the way he behaves, because of his sacrificial heart, because of his love, because of his commitment. You know, there's a lot of similar characteristics there. Somebody else had a question? Okay.
But that's just what it made me think of. You know, there's a lot of symbolism and
uh-huh.
rainbow and this promise, sexism and this promise, and this. And I know Boaz is a person, but I was like, man, that's like crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with this natural child versus the possible stepchild, you know, definitely reminded me of the chosen nation of Israel, mm-hmm. and then here comes the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, and Boaz or Christ making that choice, like, hey, I'll do it.
Well, see, and we're gonna tonight. I mean, at the tail end of our study, we're gonna get in and we're gonna talk about Christ as our Redeemer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were a Jew and you were living in the first century and you were reading the Gospels, and you were reading the letters of Paul or Peter, and you read about Christ as the Redeemer, that's language that's rooted in Israel's Old Testament, in their theology. So this language of Redeemer for them has great historical and theological significance. We're not so familiar with it because we're removed from it. And that's why a study like this is so great, because it gets us into the culture, it gets us into the scripture, it gets us into the theology of their day, so that we can understand what the word meant to them, and therefore we get the richness of these theological terms as they're applied to us, because we have been redeemed.
With a stepchild, that's going to get some inheritance.
Yeah, exactly. Because of the blessing, because of the price paid by another person.
Right.
Right? So, no, that's great. Okay, so he says, redeem it for yourself, latter part of verse 6. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. Now, verse 7 gives us a custom here. It says, now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption and exchange of land to confirm any matter. So the writer here, and again we're presuming that it's Samuel the prophet, and we talked about that when we went through the introductory points, but he's explaining something in his culture that may not have been understood. So he's taking a moment to explain this cultural practice. And what is it? That a man removed his sandal and gave it to another. And this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So it could be, the understanding is that by taking the sandal off and giving it to Boaz, the sandal, I mean, you think about where we walk. And the sandal, the bottom of the sandal is where your foot treads. And sometimes it was a picture of ownership. And so by giving up the sandal, he was in effect giving up his right to own the land. Because remember that he's just forfeited that. Right, he's passed it to Boaz. And so the taking off the sandal is the picture of that forfeiture, of that right. And Ryrie has a note on that, I think, that is fairly straightforward. He says in, according to Ruth 4:7, he says, handing over the sandals symbolized handing over the right of redemption to Boaz. So he's giving it over to Boaz so that Boaz can pay the price.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
The relative can never come back and want to take it.
Not once he forfeits it. Yeah, at this point, he's passed it off to Boaz. Boaz understands his legal right according to the Mosaic law. And so at this point, once Boaz exercises that right, it's a done deal. So, yeah, he's forfeiting it. There's no going back now. So picking up in verse 8, so the closest relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and he removed his sandal. Verse 9, then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Now Elimelech was the husband of Naomi, and Chilion and Mahlon of her two daughters. Verse 10, moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today. And so that conforms with what we read over in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Verse 11, and all the people who were in the court and the elders said, we are witnesses. And then they said, may the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah. And these were Jacob's two wives. You have to go back and read the Genesis account to understand the historical reference there. Both of whom built the house of Israel. They built it also along with their two maids, Bilhah and Zilpah. And you can read about that in Genesis chapter 30, verses 1 through 13, and the surrounding passages as well. But it was through these four women that Jacob gave birth to the 12 sons who became the tribes of Israel. So they're praying for an abundance both upon Boaz and for Ruth. And then it goes on and it says, and may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Well, their request was fulfilled because Boaz and Ruth did become famous. And of course, we have a whole book of the Bible, small as it is, as wonderful as it is, dedicated to them. Verse 12, moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. And if you remember in the Genesis 38 account, that Judah wound up becoming, in effect, the surrogate father. He became a surrogate father to the children that were born to Tamar. And so there's a similar relationship there between Judah and Tamar, because Judah fulfilled that obligation. Let's see. So again, verse 12, moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this man. Verse 13, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive. Now, we have looked at the issue of providence throughout this book, okay, and that means that God controls the circumstances right down to the tiniest details. One of the verses that speaks about the providence of God is Proverbs 16:33, which says the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. And so, again, what seems to us to be mere chance is ultimately under His sovereign control. But in this case here, God honors and blesses the union between Boaz and Ruth, and it says that He went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive. Now, the womb was ultimately controlled by God. And there's a few passages that speak to that. Go back with me to Genesis chapter 16. Genesis chapter 16. And these are just a few verses that we'll look at that shows how God is involved in the lives of people, even with regard to whether or not they bear children or not. And believers understood this, by the way. They understood that it was under God's sovereign control. So So starting like in Genesis 16:1, it says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar." Now, we know about Operation Hagar and how that turns out. History still bearing the consequences of that decision. Verse 2, "So Sarai said to Abram, 'Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children through her.' And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai." But, you know, she realizes when she says, "God has prevented me from bearing." And so it's this understanding that God controls the womb. Go with me over to Genesis 29:31. And this is the Jacob account with Rachel and Leah. In verse 31 it says, "Now the Lord said..." Let me find something here. Pause this for a second.
That's right. Yeah, I was like 31.
Okay, so so let's look at verse 30 real quick in Genesis 29:30. "Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb..." It says, "Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." And so God here again controls the womb. But notice down in chapter 30, verse 1, "Now when Rachel saw that she had borne Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister, and she said to Jacob, 'Give me children or else I die.'" As though somehow it's in Jacob's control, as though somehow he has some say over this. Verse 2, "Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said to her, 'Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?'" I mean, he one can understand why he gets upset at this, because basically she's asking him to do what only God can do. And but anyway, these are examples here of opening the womb. But notice chapter 30, verse 2. "Then Jacob..." Oh, yeah, right, because he said, you know, "Am I in the place of God?" But then notice verse 21 of chapter 30. Am I in the right verse here? Oh, verse 22. "Then God remembered Rachel..."
Verse 22?
Yeah, chapter 30, verse 22. "Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb." So this is one of those examples of the sovereignty of God, of the providence of God, and we see it here in the case with Boaz and Ruth, that the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Going back to the notes here, verse 14. "Then the woman said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today.'" Now this blessing from the Lord is going to be received by Naomi. But do you remember the initial words? Because if you go back to Ruth chapter 1, and you look at verses 19 through 21, and this is when Naomi came back from the land, remember when she was in the Moab, Ruth 1:19. "So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And it came about when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was stirred because of them, and all the women said, 'Is this Naomi?' And she said to them, 'Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara,'" which again means bitterness, "'for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me.'" And basically she puts it on God. She blames God. Do you ever meet people like that? You know, they're angry at God because they feel like God has given them a dirty deal. And when I meet, by the way, and you really, there have been times where I have talked to people who have been angry with God, lashed out at God. And what I find is when I talk to them, at some point in their past, they feel like God gave them a dirty deal, that God failed them in some way. And there's usually some point of reference in their thinking where they feel that God failed them, and that often becomes the basis for their bitterness.
Right.
Now, perception, this is one of those examples where perception is not equal to reality. But that is her perspective, nonetheless. I mean, that's the way she feels about it. Verse 21, "I went out full, But the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord is witness against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? Well, in short time, she's now going to enjoy the blessing of the Lord, because even though she's angry at God, God is still going to bless her. This is God's mercy. This is God's goodness. This is God's chesed love. So the women said to Naomi, again verse 14, "Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous in Israel." And it is going to become famous. Verse 15, "May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age." Now here I think that they're basically asking that the child will care for her in her later years. And then there's going to be this wonderful praise given about Ruth, "For your daughter-in-law who loves you and is better to you than seven sons." Wow. That's quite a testimony, quite a praise report there. Has given birth to him. And again, last time, remember, we talked about the character of Ruth, what kind of woman she was. That she was willing to leave her family, her land, and she was going to go back to a land that she, or go to a land she didn't know, trusting in Yahweh, trusting in the God of Israel, committing herself to care for Naomi. She basically sacrificed her life, but she demonstrated herself to be a woman of honor, a woman of commitment, a woman of virtue, a woman of integrity. Verse 16, "Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse." That is, she's going to care for him. "And the neighbor women gave him a name." The names were normally given by the father. But here we have the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." So they named him Obed. And Obed means one who serves. You heard of the name of Obadiah. That Yah ending is Yahweh. Anytime you see that on the end of a name, like Jeremiah or Obadiah, that Ah ending, that Yah ending is for the name of Yahweh. By the way, when you see the E-L on the end of a name, that is short for Elohim, like Daniel. You see that on the ending. But Obed here means one who serves. And it could perhaps be a reference to serving Naomi in her old age. Because again, having a son was very important. Then we have this genealogy which connects this book with the next book. This is it's like some transitional verses. So that when you're reading the book of Ruth serves as a bridge between the period of the judges and the period of the kings. Because we get into this dark period of the judges, and Ruth gives us this bright spot. And from this bright spot, we're going to have this genealogy, which is going to bring us down to Israel's good king, which is David. And so the book of Ruth serves to bridge this historical gap in Israel's history to show the transition from the period of the judges into the period of the kings. And specifically with reference to David as Israel's good king. Again, I mentioned before, when you read through 1 and 2 Kings and you read about the kings of Israel, they were always compared to David. David was always the ideal standard of what God expected in a king for Israel. And so the kings of Israel, or Judah, when the kingdom split, was always compared to David. And it was either he followed in the ways of his father David, or he did not follow in the ways of his father David. But David was always the standard. You read that little clause and you read it throughout Kings over and over again, because David again becomes the standard. Now David did a lot of things right. He was obedient to the Lord. He loved the Lord. He was very humble. He obeyed the Lord. He loved his word. Now, David wasn't a perfect guy. David had his flaws, and sometimes they were great, and David suffered for those flaws. But David was always willing to handle his sin in a biblical way, to bring it to God through the sacrificial system at the time, which was the means of restoration. We have simple confession. It's a little less gooey for us. Although I'm sure that the altars there smelled like a barbecue going all the time. I drive by some of these barbecue places, I catch a whiff of that brisket that's cooking. You know, makes you hungry, but maybe it's just me. So anyway, they're given the name of Obed. Then we have this transition here. It says, "And he is the father of Jesse, the father of David." And so, again, the fact that we have David here mentions brings us most likely that the author of the book of Ruth was alive during the time of David. Because, again, David's mentioned here. David is held in very high light. It shows the nobility, the historical nobility of David's line, that he comes from a godly line. And so, therefore, it's consistent with David to be a godly person, considering his heritage. But, again, the writer stops with David. And so it's commonly taken that since the writer stops with David, that David was his contemporary. You see? And that's how sometimes when, you know, scholars are reading some of this material, they're thinking through this. And so this is often the conclusion that's drawn. Verse 18, and then it's going to back up. It says, now these are the generations of Perez. Remember, Perez was the son of Judah and Tamar. So this traces it back, and this is going to show David's lineage to the patriarchs. Because it's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob has his 12 sons, of whom Judah, remember David is from the tribe of Judah, and Judah married Tamar, and through Tamar conceived Perez. So this is going to show David's lineage back to the patriarchs. It's going to show him in the tribe of Judah. And by the way, it's from the tribe of Judah that Messiah will come. And that was prophesied, that the scepter will not depart from Judah. And that reference is ultimately to the Messiah. And so, again, here we have that these are the generations of Perez. So, again, it's linking it back to the son of Judah and Tamar. Again, the offspring of Judah being the offspring of Jacob, one of the patriarchs. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram Aminadab, and to Aminadab was born Nahshon, and to Nahshon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David. And so it follows this lineage down ultimately to David. So God did bless Boaz and Ruth. And ultimately, this is going to be brought right down to Messiah. Let's look at a few verses in Matthew real quick and show the connection here. Because, if you're looking at the coming of Christ into the world, if you're looking at him as the Messiah, you would have asked certain questions. Is he a Jew? Is he connected to Abraham? Okay. Is he in the line of David? Because you think of the Davidic covenant. But is he going to be connected to the patriarchs? Is he going to be in the tribe of Judah? Is he going to be a descendant of Abraham? And these are all going to be critical questions that any Jew, because it's going to have to fit genealogically, because God is very specific as to who the Messiah will be and what tribe he will come from and through whom the line will eventually come to Messiah. That's why when you get to Matthew 1:1, it says the record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. And who is he? He's the son of David. He's the son of Abraham. And then in verses 3 through 6, now we have here this, again, this same genealogy brought up by Matthew. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Aminadab, and Aminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. By the way, this is the first mention of a woman in any genealogy in the Bible. Women were not mentioned in the genealogy. You read the Old Testament genealogy, they were all men. And by the way, what do we know about Rahab? Right? Was she born a Jew?
No.
No, but she was brought in by faith, wasn't she? So Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth. Well, here's a woman who comes in who's a Moabitess. Okay? And then we have down in verse 6, we have the father, Jesse was the father of David the king, and David was the father of Solomon by Bathsheba.
All these
who had been the wife of Uriah. And so we have these references to these women here. And then finally, the fourth woman that is mentioned is the one down in verse 16, that Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah. And so you have these references to these women who were brought in. And by the way, even though Rahab and Ruth, and there's even a question about Bathsheba, because she was the wife of Uriah, but Uriah wasn't a Jew either. What was he? He was a Hittite. Right? Huh? Well, that's the question as to whether or not she was. Many think she was not because she married a Hittite. So a lot of people think that even she may not have been a Jew by birth. But what brings them into the lineage was that they became God's people by faith. They believed in God and the promises of God, and that brought them into the covenant relationships with Israel. And it's because of their faith that they were brought in, though Gentiles, and though they had a very colored background, many of them, they were brought in by faith and ultimately wound up in the line of Messiah himself. What a display of God's grace, right? It's all about the goodness of God. And so again, when we follow the genealogical record down through, even from Ruth down to the time of Christ, the fact that they're brought in, I think is such a beautiful display of God's sovereignty, of his providence, of his grace. Anyway, but it shows that line down through there. But again, it gives us some historical reference point that these aren't just names, that we know something about these people. We know something about the historical, references to them. And it makes the text a little more rich when we read through it, when we understand it. So.